This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Glee Gum, an independent certified women-owned business dedicated to linking world communities and creating environmentally and socially responsible products. Learn more at gleegum.com. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here for our 18th episode. You're going to love today's guests, the authors of New Erotica for Feminists, which is a delightful little book of satirical vignettes that dare to treat women as people. But first, I have a few reminders. Feminist Book Club will be at Wordplay, sponsored by the Loft Literary Center, next month, May 11th and 12th. This festival is a celebration of all things books and writing and reading, so be sure to check it out if you're in the Twin Cities or make a trip here. Hopefully the weather will be beautiful by then. It's raining today, but hopefully it'll be beautiful then. You'll have the opportunity to take workshops and listen to lectures from incredible authors like Amy Tan, Dave Barry, Stephen King, Nicole Chung, Danny Shapiro, and so many more. And then once you do that, find our booth by the food trucks. Say hello and purchase your exclusive Wordplay Feminist Book Club box. We'll also be raffling off a 6-month subscription, so you'll want to get it on that too. There's a link to learn more and get your wristbands in the show notes. Next, I want to remind you that I'm teaching an introduction to podcasting course on Monday, May 13th at Modern Well in Minneapolis. If you've ever wondered how to get your thoughts into a computer, onto the internet, and into someone's ears, I'm covering all the basics. And I'll be around to answer any and all questions about podcasting and getting your podcast idea off the ground. The link to register for that is in the show notes. Now, let's chat a bit more about our May Feminist Book Club box. As I mentioned in the last couple of episodes, we're reading Shrill by Lindy West for May. If you've already read it or maybe just binged the new Hulu show, which got picked up for a second season, congratulations. If you're feeling the urge to chat about it with some badass feminists from around the world, consider joining at our virtual membership level. This $12 membership fee gets you access to our super secret discussion group, as well as our video chat at the end of the month. It also helps support this show. Many podcasters ask their listeners to support their shows on Patreon or something along those lines, but this is even better because you'll be stepping into an established, supportive, vibrant community of women who love books and feminism. I mean, what could be better? Plus, we'll send you a little welcome gift for joining at this level. You always have the option of signing up for the full subscription box, which of course I highly recommend. Our May boxes are so fun. I've already announced that subscribers will receive a Darling Handmade elastic bookmark from Book Art Bookmarks to adorn their copy of Shrill, as well as a bottle of nail polish from Parchment in the exclusive shade named just for us. It's called Feminist. I love it so much. I'm wearing it right now. In addition to that, I'm excited to share you'll also receive packages of Glee Gum. Glee Gum is based out of Providence, Rhode Island, and we're actually the first gum in the world to be non-GMO verified. Interesting. Subscribers will receive both sugar-free and sugar-friendly options, and all products are allergy-friendly, gluten-free, kosher, vegan, with no artificial flavors, sweeteners, colors, preservatives. Basically, it's like the nicest, cleanest, tastiest little gum you could ever try. Plus, it's woman-owned business. The flavors are phenomenal. I'm personally a big fan of the mixed berry flavor, but they obviously offer traditional bubblegum, wintergreen, those classics for you classic gum chewers. I can't wait to see what you think of this fabulous woman-owned company and US-made product. Be sure to use the code podcast at feministbookclub.com/shop to reserve your May box today. We're shipping out on May 1st, so don't wait. Now I'm thrilled to introduce the authors of New Erotica for Feminist. Be sure to enter to win a copy of this fabulous book. The link is in the show notes alongside all of the ways that you can read more, stay in touch, read all of these writings of these fabulously funny, wonderful women. Hey everyone, welcome back. Today I am sitting down with the authors of New Erotica for Feminists. I cannot wait to talk to these ladies. We're sitting down with Caitlin, Brooke, Fiona, and Carrie couldn't make it, so we've got three of the four authors. Caitlin Kunkel, Brooke Preston, Fiona Taylor, and Carrie Whitmer are comedy writers and satirists whose work have been featured in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and many other outlets. Together, they co-founded and edit the website The Belladonna, which responds to today's culture, news, and politics with comedy and satire written by women writers by all definitions, which we love. The Belladonna has been called the New Onion by The Vulture, and the editors are some of the, quote, gatekeepers of American humor by The Writer magazine. Welcome, Caitlin, Brooke, and Fiona.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Caitlin, you are the one that reached out to me, and so I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about your definition of feminism, what feminism means to you, and who you are, and a little just short intro.
All right, cool. So my name is Caitlin Kunkel. I am a satirist. I'm a teacher. I'm a producer. I actually co-founded the very first Satire and Humor Festival this past March, so a couple weeks ago as of this recording. And I teach for Second City, and I've taught at colleges across the U.S. teaching satire and comedy and other things like that. So I'm big on access to information. I really think that everyone can write good satire that matters to them if they just understand how to do it. So that's really like the kind of the foundation of both the festival and the teaching that I do. And then in terms of feminism, when we've been on book tours, we've been using like the most basic definition. We'll say like feminism means, you know, you believe in equality between all genders. And the kind of the sad thing is like, you'll see some people nod, like they're like, oh yeah, like, okay, that's connecting with me. So that's the really like kind of baseline one that we're using to get people on board. But for me, it means like, you know, obviously the gender element of feminism, but it also means, you know, an awareness of dealing with issues in the world that's born out of like understanding your place of privilege, other people's place of privilege, and looking at that like across different lenses and just being aware that, you know, there are people beneath you and people above you, but ideally you're working to help like put a hand out behind you to help people behind you come up as well.
It's beautiful. Thank you. I'm going to move over to Fiona. Same question. Tell us a little bit about you and what feminism means to you.
Hi, I'm a satire writer and a fiction writer. And professionally, I'm a content strategist. In terms of what feminism means to me, I feel like I'm doing like a debate talk.
No, there's no wrong answer and no wrong definition.
I'm echoing what Caitlin said about the basic definition that we've been throwing out, because I think we realized as we were writing this, I mean, I think we all realize a lot of people don't understand what feminism actually is, but it's really like about equality ultimately. So we've been using that to sort of placate people a little, to bring them on board so that they understand that feminism is not really about women trying to take over the entire world and press men and like situations like that. In terms of what it means to me, I think we realized as we were writing this book, just how hard it is to delve into every aspect of it. I mean, there's so many things that play into equality, feminism, race, economic. And while you're tackling things in a satirical way, you can touch on some of them, but it's as for a white woman, I think we realized it's not necessarily we're not necessarily in the position to tackle all of those, because we don't have the unique perspective that, you know, we only have our perspective. We can't bring all aspects to it. So that was something that I think we struggled with. And then another thing that I think was a realization to us is that as we were writing this, we realized just how much of the patriarchy we sort of internalized and how hard it is to break out of that and really write a fantasy that's really a true fantasy, as opposed to something limited by like, oh, it would be great to have 50-50 Congress, you know, like that's a big dream and that says a lot. I don't know that that was a succinct answer, but I don't know that there is a succinct answer to that question. So.
No, there's not. And I'm going to pull at some of those threads later, because you address a lot of that in the book. And so I want to chat a little bit about that. But Brooke, How about you?
Hi. So I am also a comedy and satire writer. And then, you know, by day, I'm also a copywriter and reporter freelance as well. And I also teach at Second City in the program that Caitlin created in the satire writing program, which has been great. And I teach here. I'm the one that lives in Ohio. I live in Columbus, Ohio. I also teach here at the Thurber House. I teach workshops for them pretty regularly, as well as Mad Lab and some other local theaters. So that's been really great. As far as the feminism question, I feel like they both really nailed it. So I'm going to cop out and say just yes.
Co-sign.
Co-sign on all of that. I'm not sure I could say it any better. You know, everything that they both said, especially the part about, you know, that it was challenging in a, especially in the truncated timeline, which we can talk about. Like this book was, you know, based on a viral piece in McSweeney's. And so the timeline was moved up. We wrote the book in basically just under 3 months. So trying to tackle the whole of feminism and sort of put that button on it, like, this is it. You know, you're not going to be able to hit everything in one satire gift book, but, you know, we hopefully have at least hit and connected with some of those threads.
Absolutely. And I'm going to start us off by reading a paragraph in your introduction, which you name Foreplay, which I think is hysterical.
I mean, we had to.
You had to.
We had to, yeah.
So you write, "Erotica invites readers to imagine themselves in different scenarios. Our book is no different. We hope we've left just enough room in each vignette for you to slink in as the main character. In that vein, we've intentionally removed many identifiers to allow a diverse array of readers to superimpose themselves onto the page. While feminists of many ethnicities and orientations are celebrated and name-checked throughout, we strive to be responsible allies rather than presuming to speak on behalf of another's experience or struggle. We've also included a resource chapter inviting and emboldening us to get more involved in relevant issues and step outside our normal spheres." So I think what you've done here is you've set the stage really early on that even though it is written by a white feminist, it's not necessarily about white feminism or for white feminists. It's something that all of the identifiers are kind of cleared out. I mean, there are some pronouns, but there's still the pronouns within it. I think you do a really good job of like suggesting queer relationships and non-binary folks. And so I think it is really kind of a slate that you can pop yourself into no matter what your identification is. So snaps to you. Wonderful job. Thank you for that. You've achieved what you set out to do. I read into that very well. So I want to talk about, since you are all kind of satire experts, I want to talk about the very basic. What is satire?
Well, the kind of the most basic definition that I use a lot, especially when I teach at colleges, is that satire is the comedy of outrage. And I think the reason I like to associate an emotion with it, like right off the bat, is I firmly believe that you cannot write good satire unless you have a point of view that you feel very strongly about. So all like the writing exercises I lead people through, I encourage them to start from a place of anger or despair or outrage or like all the negative emotions, even like really pure joy. Like start with something that moves you and then kind of like clarify your topic and what you think about it from there. But like I personally really hate like soulless satire where it's like, okay, this is in the news, so you wrote a piece making fun of it, but it doesn't seem like you have a real critique that's fueled by, you know, anger or facts or your feelings. So for me, that's like my foundational definition that I give people, and then we expand on it from there.
Okay, so I actually wrote down the question, satire is often a channel for anger. Does that ring true for you? So I'm just going to throw that out because obviously, yes.
Oh, it does. We all write satire when we get angry.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think go ahead, Brooke.
Oh, I was just going to say in the Second City classes that I teach, one of the notes that I'll give sometimes is like, oh, well, you kind of drifted into, this is sort of empathetic. Like it's too sad. It makes people think about something sad. And that sort of drains the comedy out of it, even though there very well might be something very tragic about, you know, an element of what they're writing about. And I'll say like, go back to the point of that flashpoint of what makes you angry, like the injustice about it rather than the sadness about it. Because I feel like the most shared pieces are sort of at that intersection of like just fun and joy and laughter, but also that spark of anger that makes them share it with someone else.
Yeah. And I think one thing we discovered writing this is we all have a lot of rage and we dipped into it at certain points. And then, you know, like we were all, I think, enraged at sort of different points within the book. So it worked out.
So I'm going to put on like my Bill O'Reilly hat and say, what are you so angry about?
Oh my God.
Where to begin?
We've only got an hour.
I know. I made like a rage doc on my computer and just like, it literally was like, I would have to like time myself because I could just write it all day long. But like, for me, I generally start looking outward. So I read the news and then I pull things from the news. I pull things from, you know, societal trends. That's where I think like Twitter is really useful for writing things like this. Cause you'll see like, you know, people do Twitter threads where they're like, you know, if women wrote men the way men write women. And then the joke is that like, it's always about like our breasts, like falling out of our shirts as we like bend over. So you look at things like that and you're like, oh, what's kind of like the societal thing underneath that I'm really mad about. So I just like get in my feelings for a little bit and like really like stew angrily. And then once I kind of have that raw material, I would look at like the erotic side of it because I'd have to try to combine them. So for me, that's how like a lot of them came into fruition.
Yeah. And I think I would add that, you know, you just look at the news today, every day for the past 2 years at least. And it's even hard to write satire because the things that are out there that are happening are so like, if you wrote it down for a novel, an editor would be like, too crazy, sorry, reel it back. So it's hard to like really heighten that and push past reality into satire at this point.
And I want to know more about why the erotica genre. Are you romance readers? Or why did you go that with that angle?
We're not romance readers.
We're not.
Yeah,
really.
Go ahead, Brooke.
Oh, I was just going to say we're not really, although Carrie became our erotica researcher during the process for this. Just she started reading all the different, you know, just historically about it. And then as well, just like reading a lot of forms of it. Although from a very like cold clinical place, I feel like she would report back. Yeah, it was more just like a G-chat that we have going all the time between the four of us as we edit the Belladonna, the website that we run and founded together. And it just sort of like came out of a funny chat about, you know, we always are talking about potential monetization options in the future. And I think we mentioned in the foreplay section of the book, but basically we just started joking about, I said, we should just get like a sparkling water company to, you know, we drink so much of it. Like we should just get them to sponsor us. And that's like a lot easier. And then I'm like, but I should be clear. I don't really know what a sponsorship, like how that works. In my mind, I think it's just like a box truck backs up in your driveway and Tom Hardy gets out and like plays with your rescue dog and brings you free water. And Fiona said that sounded like porn for Brooklyn women.
It's like that old Diet Coke commercial. Do you remember that? Where the Diet Coke guy was like all hot and sexy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so like from there, we just started, you know, just making each other laugh about that and just writing them to each other. And we wrote the one that's actually on the back cover of the book here. He calls me into his office and closes the door to promote me. He promotes me again and again. I am wild with ecstasy. Okay. So that was the only one that was really written like word for word right out of the gates. And then Caitlin was like, this is a piece. Like, this is funny. And open a Google Doc. And we all just started throwing them in. But I think to your earlier point about rage, it really, like, I think we realized immediately, like, we'd hit on this nerve of like the idea that it would just be erotic for women just to be treated in a safe human way.
Yeah.
And how
so sad.
And going back to the rage, like, so that office one, like, I think everyone gets it. It's funny. It's erotic. But also like that, we wrote that about Matt Lauer, like locking his employees into his office. So like, it actually is born out of a news story, but you wouldn't know that reading it. And we like kind of made a lot of them more timeless, but they were inspired by like actual things in the news.
Mm-hmm. Holy shit. That puts a whole new spin on it.
Yeah. It's a lot darker when you know that like, it's about like your boss, not like locking you against your will into his office to sexually harass you.
Cool.
Right. And just a funny anecdote about the process of writing the book. In the original McSweeney's piece, we had one that mentioned Louis C.K. because that was kind of around the time, like shortly after all of that had initially come to light. And when we were repurposing some of those from the McSweeney's piece into the book, our editors were sort of like, we might want to change this to someone else because it's probably not going to be newsworthy by the time the book comes out. And Caitlin, you said something like very prescient about that.
I said like, if like history holds, he's going to be starting his comeback right about a year after it all happened. And then like, sure enough, like a month before the book came out, like he started his comeback in New York and it was like, oh my God, like, I'm so glad we didn't take it out, but also I'm so depressed about that.
Right.
And didn't he, wasn't his set like leaked online or something? And then he was pissed about it because he didn't give consent. And it was just like, that's cute.
Yeah. There was also a female heckler who I guess just said to him, like, show me your dick, which to me is like the funniest, most obvious heckle. And he was totally flummoxed. Like, it had never occurred to him that someone would say that to him. And she got like kicked out of the Comedy Cellar in New York, which is, you know, a theater that's allowing this to happen. Also, like, they're putting him up without telling people. It's always a surprise. Yeah. So then, like, if you want to leave, you have to walk past the rest of the club. So yeah, like, the Comedy Cellar is very bad for what they're doing. I'm just going to put that on the record.
Yeah. Yeah. And if that woman, that heckler, wants to come on the show, just get in touch.
Yeah, I'll look up her name. But yeah, I'll look up, there's a piece about it. But yeah, like, I'm like, you're a hero. You did it.
Totally.
Also, the comedian Kelsey Kane now has a character that she's touring with called Penis CK, which is just like a really exaggerated version of Louis CK with like Cheeto dust around his mouth and a like prosthetic penis hanging out of his shorts.
And who is this? Who is this comedian?
Kelsey Kane.
Okay, we're going to link to her in the show notes because she sounds right up our alley.
Yeah, she's the best. She's super nice and she's the best. But yeah, she's created this character that she tours with.
Amazing. Now. Well, I want to go back before the Belladonna, back before this. How did you all find each other?
Facebook has its uses, I guess. There is a... Besides Russian meddling, there was a Facebook group for female satire writers that we all belong to. And Carrie had posted one day saying, I'd like to start up a website. Would anyone like to do it with me? And I remember posting, I would, even though I was like, who is this person? And she seems normal, but I don't know her. And I think, Caitlin, you were the one that also posted, and Caitlin and Brooke know each other in
We knew each other when we both lived in Portland, Oregon. She actually taught a class when we were both part of the Curious Comedy Theater community there when I was like 9 months pregnant with my daughter. Oh my God. And I remember telling her on the last, I have to miss the last class because I'll be in labor. And she was like, that's legit. Like, that's okay.
And so I knew that like Brooke was someone she'd also taken at that point. I had written the online satire classes for Second City and Brooke had taken them and she'd been great. And I was like, I know someone who's really great at this kind of writing and she lives in the Midwest and there's no reason that like she can't do it from there. And that's like a huge part of the website's mission too, is to like support and promote the work of women writers of all definitions from outside of New York and LA and Chicago. Like, I thought it was great to have someone working for the site who like didn't live, who all three of us live in New York. But we have a ton of writers from the Midwest. We have some writers from Australia. Like, really, like, it's interesting, like, which parts of the country that people like really like to submit from. Like, we had a variety hour in Ohio that had a lot of people on it and a lot of people in the audience.
So tell me more about the writing process. You mentioned, Brooke, I think that you wrote it all in 3 months. The start to finish, like start date to publication was 10 months. Is that what I read?
Mm-hmm. It was actually, so we wrote the piece in February. Well, we wrote it in January. The piece went up in February. We had book deals in the US and the UK by the end of March. And then the first draft of the book was due June 7th.
Oh my God.
And then we edited it that summer. And then we were done editing by early September and it came out in November.
Okay. How?
Like,
we're very tired.
Yeah. We like powered by tears.
Yeah.
It sparks like water.
I think it helps that there are four of us. Like, whenever I've seen occasionally, like, there's always a few trolls on, you know, Goodreads and things like that. And so occasionally, well, even though the reviews overall have mercifully been great, you'll occasionally have someone that's like, did it really take four of you to write this? And I'm like, it sure did. It 100% did. And if this person had offered, we would have taken them up on that as well. Because, you know, we all have day jobs and families and we're running the website as well. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a full court press for a long time.
I will say it was helpful that so our editors in the US and the UK actually work together. And so we would submit, like, we did it in batches. So we submitted the first batch of like 4,000 words. And then like, while they reviewed it, we immediately went to work on the second batch. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's more akin to like writing for the internet anyway. So that like was almost easier for us just to be like, all right, they have it. Let's like push forward with this next round of stuff. And then by the time we got edits, they had the new stuff to work on. So it was never like, oh, the whole manuscript is in. Now we're just sitting waiting for edits. It's like, who cares what they're editing? Let them do their job. We have to keep producing. And we've talked, we have a lot of other friends who have published books and their process will be like 2 years start to finish. And in some ways that sounds great to have more time to like space things out. But in other ways, it was kind of nice to just have this like nutso 2018. And now it's like out there, it lives in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
I have a question about, and if I have a question about it, I feel like the listeners will have a question about it. What do you mean you had editors in the UK and the US? Are there two separate versions of this book?
There are. So there's, it's essentially the same manuscript and it's called New Erotica for Feminists in the UK as well. But it has a different cover that's really beautiful. I'll send it to you. They did like, they use Nora Ephron's Heartburn as a comp. And it looks like almost like nice wallpaper. It's yellow and purple. But then when you look closer, it's all erotic fruits that are like ejaculating. So it's like very British where it like looks classy. Mm-hmm. And then you look closer, you're like, oh my God. And so we worked with them. They were great. Both our teams were all women, the editing teams, and they worked together. And then the only things we changed were like, we swapped some names out of like American actors for European people. We swapped out some words, obviously, like lift for elevator, things like that. But it's almost entirely the same in both countries.
You just had to translate it to the Queen's English.
And like we had a Target vignette in the US one, and we had to find the equivalent of Target in the UK, which was surprisingly hard. I think even people in the UK were like, we're not totally
sure. End up with Primark or Tesco? Or
I think it was,
Primark,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, we ended up with TK Maxx.
Right.
Primark was one of the, like everyone had a different suggestion. That's why we were like, we don't know. So.
We also, like, I always, I'm still like a little sad about this. We had a vignette that was like a longer vignette called A Very Private Tour of the Newman's Own Salad Dressing Factory. And it was an homage to my favorite human, Paul Newman. And it's basically like being romanced by the ghost of Paul Newman and his salad dressing factory. The UK team wrote back and they were like, so we know who Paul Newman is, like, obviously, but we don't have the salad dressing here. So like, they're not going to get that at all. So we had to cut it, which was very sad. So the world has to be without their Paul Newman salad dressing erotica, which is unfortunate.
It's so sad because that honey mustard just is my favorite. And I can't have a salad without it.
Yeah, there are a lot of food safety jokes about like very high temperatures for sanitation.
That's amazing. Are you going to publish that on the website? Or is there anything that you cut that did get published on the Belladonna? Or
we published some.
We could.
We're trying to think of like how to like to maybe add some more in that vein and like do like a whole more fleshed out piece. We did write some like separate Christmas vignettes that were used a lot in the UK, and those were really fun to write. But yeah, we haven't like really collected. We did some financial vignettes as well for the Billfold, RIP. Unfortunately, they've shut down since then. But we did like take the concept and like put it into a couple like more narrow frameworks. But yeah, I mean, I think it's like once you understand like the basic premise of writing it, like everyone has to have erotica and a satirical take on like an issue in society, you can kind of just like filter them into different boxes.
So if it's okay with you all, I want to read the one that made me belly laugh the most. And it's because it was so short and just like almost absurd. And I hear, before we started recording, I hear there's a story about this too, about how this had to go back and forth with your editor.
She's talking about the Agatha Christie story.
Okay.
And I saved that for you.
So here we go. All right. This is so good. Ed Sheeran releases a new single called I'm in Love with Your Body of Work about Agatha Christie. It sells 9 billion copies, more than there are people on earth. It sells more than there are people on earth, and it's about Agatha Christie. I don't want to like talk about it till it's dead and the joke is gone, but I think it's just the fucking funniest. So,
it's delightful.
It's so simple and so silly. What was the issue?
So the issue is that, like, so we kind of like came up with a joke, and I forget, I think Brooke, maybe you like mentioned it, and we're just talking about Ed Sheeran, like In Love With Your Body, which of course is like a very weird song title, especially for children to listen to. And so we're like, what if it wasn't just someone's body? It was like their brain. So we're like, all right, their body of work. And then we start to like go through authors trying to find the right one. And we like finally land on Agatha Christie, and our editors were like, could you pick someone more well-known? And I'm like, I didn't want to be passive aggressive, but I just like Googled like best-selling authors of all time. And Agatha Christie is number one before the Bible and Harry Potter. And I just kind of like sent that back. It was like, I don't know, like, how could we get more well-known? And then when I went to London as part of the book tour, and there were like huge signs everywhere saying like Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, like on the West End, was like the longest running play in London. And I was like, she's everywhere. She is an icon.
Yeah. And I like that. I mean, you just have to pick your hills to die on. Like, they had many great edits. They were generally, our editor, Katie Zaborski, was, you know, really wise in being like, oh, well, this is maybe isn't quite from the right angle, or this might be have a whiff of, you know, tokenism, some readers or something. So she had really good reasons for cutting most things. Or she'd be like, we sadly had to lose Harry Potter reps. We tried, Carrie wrote probably 12, and we just could, they kept writing back and being like, no, these are children. This is a sex crime. And we're like, no, but it's as they're grown up. Like, they're adults now. And so she would write in the vignette, like, Hermione is now 33 years old. And they're like, nope, it's in their minds, they're still children, so we can't do it. So they're like, you have to pick your moments of like what you're going to fight for. And I love that Caitlin just took a screenshot of the Wikipedia page saying she was the best-selling author of all time and just sent it back with like a smiley face. And they were like, okay.
I just like felt very strongly about that's like my artistic integrity, like contained in one vignette.
For those of you who haven't read this yet or haven't picked it up, well, A, we're giving away a copy, so enter to win that. But B, they're not all just like three sentences. There are some that are a couple pages long, but they cover, you have it split up in erotica styles? No, not styles, but
topics.
Topics, yeah. How did you settle on these topics? We've got everyday erotica, workplace erotica, sex and dating, literary, pop culture, which is where I think you find Ed Sheeran. New erotica for feminists who are parents, hilarious, and historical erotica. Why those?
Well, we had the initial piece, and then things were moving really fast. So we actually, Carrie Fiona and I went to Brown to like teach a workshop and do a show there. And Brooke was supposed to meet us, and we were supposed to finish the book proposal. And there was like some weird freak storm on the East Coast, and all the flights were canceled.
So it was a nor'easter.
It was a nor'easter. It was not ideal. And we had talked a little bit about buckets and been working on the book proposal. And like, we like spend this whole day, we travel from New York, we do a workshop, we like do a show. We're so tired. And then like, we like open our emails and like, Brooke has like done the book proposal. Like, and she had like come up with these categories, and we were like, wow, thank you so much for like doing this. Like, she cleared her weekend anyway, obviously, to come to Rhode Island, but because she couldn't come, she just was able to like spend that time like breaking them down. And we made some edits from there, but like the overall, I think most of the chapters that are in the book ended up in that first pass.
And all credit to the editors. I think that they had suggested that we break it out into buckets rather than just have it sort of be a random pastiche of vignettes. And yeah, I was fueled by the rage of my travel plans being canceled. And I just sat and like didn't move for 12 hours and wrote.
Okay. And we love you for it. Thank you, Brooke.
I'm not really an administrative person. Like, I'm a big ideas person, not a details person. So in some ways, I consider that maybe my greatest life accomplishment.
But it also, it's so indicative of how this was, it takes a village, right? It's a little bit of everybody's efforts in different ways. It's not just writing, it's the editing, it's the book proposal, it's the marketing, it's a little bit of everything, and you're all contributing to it in different ways. And so I think it speaks to teamwork and how women just are so good at working together.
Oh yeah.
I will say this. I absolutely think that's true. I would not recommend this for brand new collaborators, especially on this timeline. I think if we had all not known each other super well, and we hadn't already edited together and known each other's sensibilities and like what we could bring to the table and built that trust in each other's work, we would have had a lot of a, you know, bumpier road. But that said, we totally obviously believe in collaboration. We love to write together, and it just feels really natural at this point. I think we have a good group mind going on, and we all truly trust that we'll make each other's work better.
Yeah. And one of the things we did was we like read the whole book through before we submitted it. And if like one person wasn't on board with the vignette, we would just cut it, because it's like, if 25% of this group like doesn't get it, then like they must represent at least 25% of readers. So like, why, if it's not clear to one of us who actually worked on the book, then it's probably not clear. So that was like a good way of making sure there aren't like things in the book that like none of us, or like one of us is like, I don't like that one, I wish that wasn't in there. So I think that's important too, is to feel like people can, you know, have a veto and it doesn't hurt other people's feelings. They're not like, no, it's perfect, it has to go in. And now your name is on a book where you're like, oh, I really hate that one joke.
Right. Yeah, that's a great litmus test too. So what do you want this book to do in this world?
Change the world. No.
Well, ideally.
Simple.
Yeah, in an ideal world, the patriarchy would fall like a house of cards. But yeah, I think that's why we included the resources section at the end, because we're aware, like, it's a satire gift book. It's short and fun, and, you know, it's a fun read. But we do hope that it, either through book clubs or just through conversations or gifting it to a friend or family member, that or your worst senator, we highly encourage sending these books to Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. Like, we hope that it starts a deeper conversation, that this can kind of be the, you know, the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down a little bit. So we acknowledge that we're not necessarily, you know, the hardest hitting feminism book in the game, but we hope that it can sort of be an easier entry point to have some of these deeper conversations and to feel empowered enough to know, oh, I'm not alone in this, and to start taking just a couple of practical steps at the end of the book, whether it's, you know, reading more books by women and women of color, to maybe running for office, or just, you know, doing something, you know, starting small and taking one additional step than you might have otherwise. That would make us feel really great.
I would agree with that. And like, we've had people say like, oh, I read the book and I laughed so much, and then I felt like really sad when I was done. And, you know, not everyone wants to feel that way. But for me personally, I think a lot of good satire can work in that way. Like, you read it and you like appreciate like how good the writing is, and how good the concept is. But then when you actually think about like the underlying point of view and the message and critique, you're like, that is, wow, dark and very sad. So I like to evoke that feeling in people. And again, like, we've had some people be like, they bought it for, you know, grandmothers, or they've talked about it with their fathers. We have had some like of our more aggressive readers give it to people they don't like. We've kind of been saying like, buy one for someone who you think will get it, and buy one for someone you think won't. And I think, like, you know, if you can get, you know, your dad to read it, who maybe isn't into feminism or erotica, then you're doing a great job.
Yeah. Hmm. And I have a cousin in Australia I have a cousin-in-law who I mailed the book to. She hasn't read it yet. It's on its way to her. But her husband, who is my cousin, and doesn't consider himself a feminist, which I think is interesting because he's married to a staunch feminist. So I suspect he is. Read the book at my other cousin's house. And she was like, he won't stop talking about it. He just keeps like telling me jokes from it. And she's like, but he says it hasn't converted him. So I'm like, okay, but it hasn't converted him. But he read it and he keeps talking about it. So like, I consider that a small victory.
Absolutely. As long as it can start a conversation, yeah, that's like, that's the most you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's absolutely starting. I think it is a great entry into those conversations. And I'm now considering sending it to my tea partying father.
My very conservative father read it, and he enjoyed the, we have a rep about, we have a vignette about the end of Titanic, the movie. Yeah. Very controversial. Jack and Rose both sitting on the door. And my dad, who I don't think has ever seen the movie Titanic, like laughed himself sick and was like, this is great. And I'm like, have you even ever seen that movie?
But to me, like, so, the most erotic part of that vignette, and like, people can read it in the book, is that like at one point, like, Jack just says to Rose, Rose, I wish I had a good education like you. And I'm like, that, yeah, to me, like, a man saying that to me would be like so unbelievably erotic. If they're like, wow, you are just so well educated.
Yes, 100%.
Well, on that note, I want to know what's next for all of you. What's next for the Belladonna? What's next for New Erotica? What's on the horizon?
So the Belladonna just celebrated its second anniversary in February.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. so proud to have published, I think, I don't know what the exact number is. I think it's somewhere in the 250 range of like writers that we've published so far. And so we're going to keep, you know, onward and upward with that. We're continuing to publish fresh content every day and are so proud of the quality of that and of all of our contributors who are amazing. And then we're working on second book concepts together. So if you liked what you read, there are some very easy ways to support us. One is by buying this book, which sounds intuitive, obviously, but that really shows publishers proof of concept that we're a viable team. So buying and reviewing this book is really helpful to us. And then also just tweeting at our publisher, Plume Books, and saying, hey, we want more would be great. So we are, we're actively kind of talking about what comes next.
Yeah. And for me, I'm working on the next Satire and Humor Festival will be in 2020. So like continuing to like kind of like pull people out from behind their computers and like get them to meet in real life and collaborate together. I think like for me personally, I've seen with a lot of my students, I've taught probably over 1,000 students satire at this point. A lot of them are start like when they first kind of come into the program, they want to write on their own. And now they see like, you know, the success of our book and like other collaborations. And now a lot of them want to meet people and collaborate. And speaking of collaborations, we should kind of call out that there are great illustrations in this book. Mm-hmm. And they're by a woman named Sarah Kempa. So her Instagram is @AuntSarahDraws. And in the time that we were, you know, doing this book, we met her just through the Belladonna. We had never met her in person until our book release party in Brooklyn. We only knew her work. So it was like pretty democratic. Like we just loved her style. She submitted something to the Belladonna that was great. We asked her if she wanted to do this with us. She was paid by the publisher. And then in the time that we did this book with her, so from March until now, she went from having like 3,000 Instagram followers to 60,000 Instagram followers. So I think, you know, it's cool to kind of work with people as they're on their way up. A lot of the people we published in the Belladonna, it's their very first credit. So we're really interested in like having people work together to kind of get better clips and know people and be able to progress faster in this career than they would necessarily alone.
Amazing. And you're doing such good work. And I'll link her in the show notes, Aunt Sarah Draws on Instagram, because the illustrations are they're just as funny and just as poignant as the vignettes in the book too. The last question I ask everybody, and I'll ask each of you, if there is a book that's not yours that you would recommend to our readers, any genre, any author, any year published, what would you recommend?
I think Gemma Hartley's Fed Up is a really good one. It's nonfiction. I also think anything by Samantha Irby is hilarious. Like I was laughing out loud reading, I can't think which one I was reading, at dance class the other day. And like all these little girls were looking at me because I was cackling away and very weird.
For me, I would say the nonfiction book I read last year that was the most interesting to me was a book called The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker. Mm-hmm. And it's a book about like the intention behind gatherings and conventions and meetings. And it just was kind of mind blowing to me because I think meetings are like something you don't even think about like structuring in any way, like having any sort of intention behind. So like as I was planning the first festival with my collaborators, like that book was like really, really important to me. And then in terms of fiction, I recently read The Witch Elm by Tana French, who's an Irish author. And it was like billed itself as like a mystery novel, but it's actually about like white male privilege, which was really interesting to me. And it just like, she's a fantastic writer. She's like one of those prose writers where like, it's like very simple, but then you realize you've been reading for 3 hours without looking up. So she just like pulls you in and drags you into the story. So that was a great book. I read that in my book club.
Yeah, she's a great writer.
Oh, interesting. I haven't heard of that one. And Brooke, how about you?
I will shout out our pal and Belladonna contributor, Kimberly Harrington. She wrote a book of essays that are mostly comedic, although it's one of those you'll laugh, you'll cry books called Amateur Hour, Motherhood and Essays and Swear Words.
Cute.
And so she's also a really popular writer on McSweeney's and a lot of other top publications. And I enjoyed that a lot.
Amazing. I will leave all of those in the show notes. I will also leave links to all of your personal work, links to the Belladonna, anything you could possibly think of will be in the show notes. Be sure to click through there. There will also be a link to enter the giveaway to win your own copy of New Erotica for Feminists. Caitlin, Brooke, Fiona, thank you so much for coming on. It has been a joy to talk to you this morning and talk more about this book and the writing. And I am so grateful that you spent your last hour with me.
Thank you for
having us.
Well, have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, 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 oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.